coal miner. I worked on the coal face, 2,000 meters below the surface. It was what you call a drift mine. What was the hospital's name on River Avenue? That would be the
Victoria
Hospital, which is now no longer. But in the year of 1919, May the 12th. Okay. And I spent the very early part of my life, first couple of years, 3 years, was spent in Winnipeg. My father worked for the Winnipeg Transit Company as a carpenter. And between the ages of 5 and 6, I spent in the northern part of Manitoba in the country, staying with my grandpeople who farmed up and around the Interlake region in the northern part of Manitoba. And I went to school there I actually started school for one year. That was that fall and all that winter. 6 years of age, and then 3 miles to walk to school. We lived, just my mother and I, at that time, lived in a log cabin on my grandfather's farm. It was in the bush. We didn't live with our people, we lived in the bush, in a log cabin, which my father had built. And that first winter, he wasn't with us. He was away working in the western part of Canada at that time, while we stayed up there during the winter. Because in them days, there was no such thing as relief and so on and so forth. You just had to get out and survive for yourself. It's still very vivid in my mind of going that first year at school up in the northern country, wintertime, 40 below, and fight my own way through 3 foot drifts. That's just on my own.
What was the name of the school?
Fairford School. It's in the northern part of Manitoba. You know, at the end of the line was Gibsonville. You may be familiar with Gibsonville. It's now a radar station there, I believe, or St. Martin is. But this is 45 years ago, roughly, 46 years ago. We started that. After which, we came back, and I left there, and we came back to Winnipeg. And from Winnipeg, we went down to the United States. My father had a big contract job in Detroit, and we lived in Detroit for about a year and a half. And then we came back to Winnipeg after his contract was out running. We came back to Winnipeg, and then my father returned to the employee of the Winnipeg Transit Company. And I started school. This time I lost, it was about 3 years intervention at the time, so I started in grade 2. It took me about 2 or 3 years to get as far as grade 2 and kind of the moving and so on and so forth. And this was in West Kelowna. We lived out in West Kelowna on Royal Avenue. And there I stayed. I went through Centennial School right on through and graduated from high school in Centennial High. And that ended my formal education. From there, as I came into manhood in the 18s, I finished school in 37. So between 37 and 39, that was in the middle of the Depression, I worked 3 months in a bush camp. And in the spring of 39, I joined the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry as a bandsman.
Which one did you play?
I played the cornet in them days. I got more formal indoctrination into playing music from the Salvation Army prior to going into the Princess Pats. My chum was in the Princess Pats also at the time. He played clarinet. That started my musical career, you might say. And I spent the time at Shiloh that summer. When I came back in the fall of 39, we came back in the last week of August. Came back in Winnipeg. And let me see. I then transferred from the Pats to the Grenadiers, and the Grenadiers were forming a band at that time, and this is the reason why I transferred, because they were forming a new band, and I went into this band in the Grenadiers, and on September the 6th, I joined the Grenadiers, the nucleus of the beginning of the band for the Grenadiers. And as you know, on September the 9th, war, I think, was declared on September the 9th. The battalion was active for, what, 3 days prior to the outbreak of war. So actually, I was in 3 days before the war started. That is, the transfer from active to into active again, you almost like to say. And then I came involved with the Grenadiers as a bandsman. And from there, I went to Jamaica as a bandsman and did about, you know, roughly about a year and a half, I believe it was, in a park camp in Kingston as a musician. And saw a great deal of the island in Jamaica, which I hope to go back to see in the very near future because of my acquaintances and my familiarity with the army, because as a bandsman I had quite a bit of leisure time on my hands and was able to make contact with quite a few influential people in Jamaica, and possibly had just a little better chance of seeing the island than rather than the men in the ranks who were pretty well tied up with duties such as guard work, ship's guard work, guard duty of that nature, which we had no part of. We were strictly musicians who went to work at 9 in the morning and finished at 11 and started at 2 in the afternoon and finished at 3. That comprised her day.
What type of work did you do?
Just practice.
Just practice.
And play concerts, and we played quite a few places over the island for different celebrities and people. We played concerts. This was our line of duty. And when we weren't playing at a concert, we were practicing music and learning to play. And there was the odd time we took a little bit of military training on the Bren gun and then the Lewis gun. It was volunteer on our part. They asked if we'd like to learn these guns other than our music. And we said, by all means. A chap by name of Sergeant Wold was our instructor. He was an ex-Pats man. Fine instructor on the Lewis. And we rather enjoyed learning that, Bren and the Lewis gun.
How many were in the band at this time?
25, counting your bandmaster. 25-piece band.
And who was the bandmaster?
And Sergeant John Malloy was our bandmaster. He took over from Sergeant Thompson, who was the original bandmaster who took us to Jamaica. And Sergeant Thompson returned to Canada, and Sergeant Malloy took over the band as the bandmaster. And we had Corporal LeGros was the disciplinary officer in our band. We just had two ranks in the band because at that time there was no actual establishment on books for band, but through the graces of our officers, this is how we had a band. It was more or less through the officers holding the ranks open for this, and consequently there was no room for to go on for rank or anything like that. So we had other compensations, such as you might say, fairly easy life, but no money. But that's neither here nor there.
So you would actually be in headquarters company?
Yes, county headquarters, yes, right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And when did you return to Canada?
Now, we returned to Canada in the fall of 41, which was September, I believe it was. And we were in Canada for 1 year, September, October. Yes, just around the end of October, when the battalion was changed from a guard battalion to an infantry battalion and forming part of the 6th Brigade. And being an infantry battalion, we had to increase our strength. See, in Jamaica, we were about 750 strong. As a guard battalion, this is required strength, but the infantry, I think we had to have somewhere around about 960 to 1,000 men to comprise an infantry battalion. And so we had to recruit at all costs to bring our number up so that we would qualify for that draft to leave for Hong Kong. This, is, in my opinion, probably was why some of the fellows were ill-trained. That is, the reinforcements. Some of them had barely been in the army, and some were on leave, and so on. But at that time, as you say, this was in such a hurry and such a rush that this was to be straightened out later when we arrived at our destination. Then further, these fellows would have been trained, and those that were categorically unfit for duty would have been returned to Canada. But as you know, history took a hand in there, and it just wasn't so. But originally, it was this is what the plan was, to build the battalion once they established themselves, because it was in such a short order. Evidently, the orders from Ottawa, which I'm not familiar with, but knowing after we come back and different things, that it was a very quick decision, and there was no, well, let's think about it, you know. You're on the boat, you're away. You know?
What was your feeling at this time? You were put on a train, destination unknown.
Mm-hmm.
What were your feelings at this time?
Not anything out of the ordinary. I mean, when we left Jamaica under a new colonel, Colonel Sutcliffe, who took over from Colonel Kay, and when we were recalled to Canada, we knew that we weren't going to stay here. It was just a matter of time that we thought possibly from here that we would be shipped to England. This is probably what the whole thing was about. Well, now we're going to go into action. Great, you know, we've had enough rest now down in Jamaica, and then a lot of us thought, well, now that we've become acclimatized to a tropical country, possibly the theater of war would be our next step, probably in North Africa, you name it, eh? So when the orders come to ship out, destination unknown, but we did draw a tropical dress, we figured, well, we're on the move again, you know. So we didn't give it too much thought as to, you know, we knew it was coming, but where was another question. We volunteered to go wherever they send us, so that was, you know, in my opinion, was understood that way. So there's no qualms about it. I know there was some of them didn't get on that boat in Vancouver. They skipped. But after all, with a number of men, you can't get 100%. Down the board, correct, can you? You know, I mean, you get to get this no matter what. It's, you know. In Vancouver, they had a little ruckus. We boarded the Awatea, and the conditions were quite cramped to what we had been used to. And being under British command, it was just a little sticklish also to what we'd been used to. We didn't go along with this British idea that the captain ruled the roost and the hold was good enough for the men, you see. We didn't think that way, and we let them know about it. And there was a threatened mutiny to leave the boat. And they did mount Bren guns on the wharf, the bank plank, and said, if you come down, we'll have to open fire. Well, then our officers got a hold of some of our chaps who were in the forefront of it, and we had to talk to them and said that these out-of-bound restrictions would be lifted, and things would be worked out tomorrow to our satisfaction if we returned to our quarters. And there was agreement reached, so we returned to our quarters, at which they weighed anchor immediately and put the boat in the middle of the stream. So if you change your mind, you're going to have to swim home. So that's our end of that little effort.
Was there any other disturbances?
None of that caliber. No, when we were on the water, the restrictions had been lifted, and our officers did agree that at that time about three quarters of that boat was out of bounds, just for officers only. And said, "Well, not likely. You know, this is going to have to be changed. You just can't." You know, we just don't go along with this imperial idea. Mm-hmm. And so it had been lifted, and the freedom of the ship was pretty well unlimited. And as a musician, we practiced on board deck, and the other regiment that we took with us, the Royal Rifles of Canada, they also had a band. And they used to give a little concert, and we would give a little concert and turn about. And this, between that and practicing lifeboat drill, and it was about what, anywhere, good 3 weeks on the high seas. We went from Vancouver straight on down to Honolulu. We docked in Honolulu for a day, and we pulled out of there and we swung away south, not to the equator, but almost to the equator, and caught a submarine scare and came back up into the Philippines and up to Manila, where we stopped for another day, and then crossed the China Sea to Hong Kong.
Was any announcement made before your arrival in Hong Kong as to what your destination really was?
Yes. After we had left, after we were on the high seas and we were coming into Manila, there was nothing official, but as to the grapevine, they said that we are going into Hong Kong, and if things don't happen, it doesn't pop all of a sudden, we'll be all right, but be prepared to fight your way off board. Whether they where this rumor came from, nobody seems to know, because it seems that this is pretty hush-hush as far as the Japanese were concerned. But there might have been possibly something in the news to do with the Japanese embassy in Washington, that little focus they had there when they returned, you see. So maybe they were sort of reading between the lines on the news, and they said that we're running into a hot spot, and somebody sort of read the reading on the wall and sort of told us that, you know, to expect anything, you know, really. It might not be as peaceful as we think it's going to be, you know, another Jamaican garrison. Well, as you say, as it happens, we marched peacefully off the boat in Hong Kong, and in Kowloon, actually, is where we docked. We didn't dock in Victoria, which is the capital of Hong Kong. We docked in Kowloon, and from Kowloon to Mary Barracks, down at the end of, can you think of the name of the street? We marched down, I guess it doesn't make any difference anyways. And we're encamped in Kowloon Barracks. And we had pretty fair time for the 3 weeks that we were not at war. Didn't do much of anything, more or less get used to the barracks. The band, we were stationed in a place called Jubilee Building, which was at the head of the Parade Square, and if anyone's familiar with the Sham Shapoe. And we were in this Jubilee Building, and we had a suite between two bandsmen. French doors opened up onto a balcony. We had a really ritzy place. We had little servants look after us. We had no polishing of brass or shining of horns to do. It was all done for you, and we just it was even more luxurious than it was in Hong Kong. And at night, we were free to go downtown and visit the high spots and the low spots, and we found them all. If we had had a little more time, they'd not got back alive. It was just too good to be true.
Who were these servants that you had?
Coolies. They're little waifs, little fellas. They were no more than 8 and 9 years old. And for 10 cents a week, you get your laundry done, and all this sort of stuff, you know, and scraps off your table, and just do anything for you, shave you in bed, bring your tea to bed if you want it, or so you name it, they had it for such a minimal cost, you know. Our money I'm not sure now, it was 5 to 1 or 7 to 1. I know it was quite high. And our rate of pay, this may seem kind of low now, but at that time was a private was $1.50 a day, as to compared to the British soldiers, which was, I think, 25 cents a day. So you can readily see that we were privates and quite millionaires, because our money was so much higher, and we were apt to spoil the civilians. I know the British troops that were there, which were the Royal Scots, the Middlesex Regiment, they, at the beginning, they had to say, no, fellas, look out, because you're going to spoil this thing, because, you know, where it costs 10 cents for a rickshaw ride, you throw them $1 and think nothing of it. Well, what do you think we're going to do? We can't afford to do this, you see. And they run into a little bit of that sort of thing. And then on a Sunday morning, when we all moved to the island, and that is the band in our section, and there's the regiment, and move over. And this is when when we moved out of the barracks, we had not been bombed as yet, but we said we were moving over into the island for maneuvers. No hint of a war or breakout of anything, except there was something in the wind, but they had said nothing. And the following morning, I was at a place called Pak Phalem on the island, and I was on the way, and the band did what you call outpost duty in the pillbox. Our band was split in half. There was 12 of us together, and the other 12 were in the other half. They were somewhere else on the island. I'm not quite sure where, but it didn't matter really. And anyway, our 12 was at Pak Phalem doing guard work, guard duty. And that particular morning, the morning that they were bombed, on December the 8th, was it, I believe? We were bringing up our food canteen for our breakfast from B Company, which is stationed in the monastery just below us. And when we came back up, we seen these planes come over one of the islands, and then we could hear the bomb being dropped, and we didn't know it was Japanese. We thought it was an American's, or even our own plane. We had a couple of planes there doing maneuvers or whatnot, you know. We didn't think too much of it until we got back to the pillbox. We had our breakfast. We took our empty canteens back down to the kitchen below, and this we were informed that we were at war, that they weren't maneuvers, they were Japanese bombers, and that we had just been bombed. Being on the far side of the island, of course, I didn't witness the bombing of Kai Tak, the airfield, which they destroyed those antique aircraft that was sitting there in 1914, yeah. And they bombed the barracks, of course, and the Japanese were marching on the New Frontier front coming into Kowloon, you see. I mean, this way, and we learn after, but at that time I knew nothing of that, all to know that we had been bombed, and we are now in a state of war with the Japanese, and sit tight and wait for further orders. Besides that, you know.
And what were your next orders received?
The next orders received, we were... Our group and the pillbox, we stayed there for about 2 or 3 days. About the fourth day, periodically we were getting news that the Japanese were moving in by runner, and that we were holding this outpost because it led up to the peak called Peak Mansions at the top. And anything coming down that we could notify the company which were below us. We were like an outpost duty, you see. I felt rather uneasy being a bandsman with a big Red Cross on my work coveralls and had a big Geneva Red Cross, which is stretcher bearer, on my arm. A couple of cases of bandoliers strung over my shoulders, rifle and bayonet and grenade. I was armed to the teeth with this red thing on here, non-combatant, you know, and I mentioned it to us. I said, you know, I said, if the Japanese ever came over that hill, and there we are, non-combatant, stretcher bear is supposed to be, and we got more armaments on us, I think, than I said we'd be just taken out and shot right there. No way out. Yeah, I know, but nobody seems to know what's what, so we just have to let it be as is. You know?
These Red Crosses, were they issued with your uniform?
Yes, they were just a white band with a red cross on it. Mm-hmm. Your stretcher bear, fire the stretcher bear equipment, you see. So, an advance guard of British soldiers came over the hill, I remember this particular morning, and they come down, they said the Japanese had landed, that they were all over the place. They're quite excitable, and they told us that we better get out of here, because otherwise we'd be slaughtered, because we're hopelessly outnumbered, and we better move out. And they were moving on down. So, and there's just 12 of us, so John Malloy was our sergeant, which was our bandmaster, as you recall. After they'd left, there was a company of them, about 20 of them, and they carried on down the mountain. So we held a little meeting and said, what are we going to do? We said, well, what we'll do is beside this pillbox on the side of the hill is what they call slip trenches. I will disperse, and we're three to a slip trench on the side of the hills, and we'll watch the crest. And if the Japanese come over, we'll open fire. They don't know how many of us there is. We'll hold them while we send a runner down to the company below to warn them so they can pull out. So we decided this is what we would do, because any moment they were coming over the hill. So we retired to, as you say, fortified positions, and the slip trench with a bayonet and gun, and that's it, and waiting. And it was rather a sinking feeling, I tell you, with nothing ahead of you or below you, waiting for them to come over so that we could make our move. Well, we waited pretty well most of the day, and nothing came over. So John says, remember sending us down a detail down for to get our supper, bring up our supper meal. Nothing had happened during the day. So he went down, and the runner, two fellows went down with the canteens to get our soup and our meal, came back empty-handed, said there was nobody down there, that the B company had pulled out during the night. And so as far as they're concerned, we were the only 12 people in the island right here, and that's it. No way. So there we are, 12 of us, no supper, waiting for the Imperial Japanese to come over the hill, and still nothing happened, luckily I might say. The next morning we decided that, well, there was no use us staying here. The company down below never even said they were pulling out. They left us high and dry, you might say. I guess they pulled out in a hurry. They must have got bugged or something. I don't know what happened down there. So we took off and went up to Peak Mansions, and up there is a hospital. We didn't run into any Japanese, but we got into the hospital, we found it, and we run into Captain Crawford. He was a captain, he's a colonel now. Captain Crawford, our medical officer. So we were kind of glad to see him. And we said, well, we come in from Pop Phalem, and we'd like to be dispersed out to the different outfits in the field as stretcher bearers. There's 12 of us here, they can use us. I remember him telling us, he says, I'm glad to see you fellas, he says, but there's no use us dispatching you anywhere, he says, because we don't know where our troops are. He says, there's nothing you can do anyways. He says, they're scattered over the island, and there's pockets of Japanese all over. He says, so we don't know where anybody is, really. Communications were bombed out almost at the beginning, so communications are cut off completely. And he says, just stay here with us, and we'll give you some work to do on the hospital, or just make yourself at home, because there's nothing I can do to send you anywhere. So this is how we arrived at Peak Mansions. And there we stayed until the end of the war, which was about 3 days, because we arrived there about the 21st or somewhere thereabouts. On the 25th day of December, when the white flag went up, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did you actually see the white flag?
No, I did not see the white flag go up. We were informed that the surrender had taken place. I was at Peak Mansions, you see, and so I wasn't at the place, the port, where the surrender was made. We do know that I remember they calling us together and told us that they told us just prior to the surrender that the surrender would be made at 3 o'clock, and then that the military had no other choice but to surrender under orders of the governor of the island. This was an imperial order. The military itself had no power in its right to surrender, and that we decided prior that we would not surrender, but owing to the massacre of the civilian population and the hopelessness of the situation, then the highest command left on the island was the governor of the island, who represented the Queen, and on the imperial order, you might say, representing the Queen, gave the military the order to surrender. This is how the military surrendered in Hong Kong. It was a direct order from the governor, not the military surrendered. And they made this very plain to us. So now, when we are taken prisoners of war, you give only your rank, name, and number, and that you did not voluntarily surrender, but were ordered to do so by your superiors. I said, that's as far as you go. This is what we did, and we took our rifles, pulled the bolts, threw the bolts away, damaged the rifle so it could not be used again, and waited for contact with the Japanese, which in our case happened the following day, on the 26th day. Japanese on a guard of motorcycle escort came up, a captain, I can't remember the name, who took over the surrender of the hospital and the prisoners of war there, and could speak very good English, was educated in Canada, could speak better English than I could, and from there where we were rounded up, and we marched back on down to a place called North Point, where we were interned in a North Point camp at that time.
These orders on the surrender, how did you receive them at the hospital?
We received them through Major Captain Crawford. There was a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, a British colonel, who was at that hospital. Now I'm just at the loss as to his name, but probably if you look in records, you could have be no problem. But he was a British colonel. A British colonel, and I just, for the life of me, can't think of his name right offhand, but it was through him who gave the order, held the conference with the officers on hand. It was, well, as I say, there was two or three of our, besides Captain Crawford, there was two or three of our officers, a lieutenant and captain, I believe, not quite sure of the number, and a couple of British officers, and they sort of held the party, you see. And it was, did the colonel reach the order from the governor? Probably by runner, but I wouldn't swear on it, but there's possibly some means of communication. It would only, could be by runner, it couldn't be by phone or nothing, because there just wasn't any such thing. So possibly a runner had gotten through, or some means of communication with the governor of the island, you see, who was still alive. I mean, he never was killed, you see. Whatever happened to him after, I don't know. I have no idea. He possibly was interned in a civilian prisoner of war camp, probably. And I don't know whether he was ever repatriated or what. I mean, records. But, you know, look into records, you could find out. But I myself don't know. You know.
Did the hospital have a name?
Pete Mansions.
Just Pete Mansions.
Yeah, Pete Mansions Hospital. Oh. Yeah, it's right at the peak. Called Pete Mansions.
Okay. Now, North Point Camp, can you describe the camp a bit in the daily life?
Yes. There wasn't too much to... It had been a refugee camp prior to us going in there. And when we first moved in, it was quite a beaten-down line of huts with a parade square in the middle of it, just an ordinary... It was a refugee camp, if you can picture that, with these long huts, with the center aisle right up the middle, dirt floors, wooden bunks for beds. In some cases, other places, no bunks at all. It was sort of really run down to the hill, nothing at the windows, like windows and like that. There was nothing in it, just like a barn, you know, practically. It was enclosed with barbed wire. Now, whether it was electrified or could be electrified, I'm not sure whether that fence was electrified or not. It might have been. I just can't recall right now. And it had a cookhouse, which from the old refugee camp of, you know, where they kept the Chinese and that in there. Incidentally, the place was just crawling with bed bugs and lice, practically walking away. And we fighting the bed bugs and hunger at the same time was a little bit of a problem, I will admit. We scrounged anything at all that we could get for survival. For example, heating materials. Some of them had just empty tin cans. And myself, I had a lampshade. Have you ever seen these porcelain lampshades that hang over a pool room table? You know, they're cone-shaped. They're green on the outside and porcelain white. Well, that's what I had for my heating utensil. I just plugged one end with a cork. And because it was porcelain, I could keep it clean. You know, it was a relatively easy way to keep it clean. And this is what I got whatever they fed us, which was at the very beginning once a day. It was a sort of a thin gruel of boiled rice and whatever they could find. And you got one cup of this sort of gruelish boiled rice with some greens in it or somewhere, whatever they could womp up in that these kitchens that they that our fellows had sort of got together at. And there was water in the camp, fortunately, so that you could drink water at least. You weren't dying of thirst, but hunger was really taking its toll. At the first couple of months of prisoner war life, you lost weight rapidly. Sores begin to break out on the fellas. Pellagra sores, which is a lack of vitamins in the system. That gaunt feeling came over them all, and taking on the shapes of human skeletons. It didn't take too long, about anywhere from 3 to 5 months when they reduced them to human skeletons pretty well. And actually, during the whole period of our almost 4 years of prisoners of war, there was never once was there ever a time in that 4 years that you ever ate a meal that you were full. Now, one exception, and that was at Christmas Day when we did get one Red Cross parcel between three men. That's a 14-pound food package between three men. And we took it upon ourselves that at least we're going to have one meal that we're going to feel, but we didn't overdo it. We just, like, for instance, a chocolate bar, I can remember quite clear in it. You're only supposed to eat a small piece of it. Well, I can remember eating the whole thing. I was full, all right, to the point of having a very bad cramps and stomach ache. But at least I was full for a period of time. And it's only once I did that because I realized that that wasn't the smart thing to do. Because after all, we were concentrating all the time on survival and nothing else mattered, really. For example, nothing was ever wasted. We did get an orange once in a while while we were in Japan. The peeling was never thrown away. You peeled an orange and then you dried the orange peelings and then you ate them after. You know, when they're dried out, you always nibble at them. You got a certain amount of citric acid on them, probably. I've eaten grass just for the mere fact that there was something in grass that could possibly balance your diet. Always in your mind was how to survive. Just how to get food. And I have myself been in, especially in Japan when I was in a working party, many times I found it difficult to come back from a working party without passing out, just from pure weakness and hunger. And you're supposed to be working. Well, you did what you could, and that's all, in that respect.
Was there any medicine at all in one camp?
Yes, there was, but very, very sparingly. For example, in North Point and in Shamsupo, this is prior to me going to Japan, you see, because I was one who went in the labor battalion. I was being a bandsman, then I was designated to work in the camps, in the prison camps, in what you call the MI room or the orderly room, where we could administer a medical help, whatever we had, like somebody gets scratched, and you know, there was really very, very little medicine. There was a little chloroform. I can remember us through the black market getting hold of a 26 ounce of chloroform. This is black market, never issued to you, but it was done through dickering with one of the guards at the barbed wire fence for an idea. And our Sergeant Mawson was our, I worked with him, and in his civilian life he was a chemist, and he knew how to make cough syrup out of chloroform, which is, you know, cough mixture has got chloroform in. I think the part is 5 to 1. Five parts water, one part chloroform, and sweetened with sugar, and you've got the best cough medicine you ever want. We mixed this up very, very weak because Crawford told us that too much of this stuff is bad on the heart, being chloroform, and we haven't got such good hearts to start with. But the odd one determined it was such a bad cold or something that we'd maybe give him a half spoonful of this, and this was more of a mental attitude more than a cure. It was really a waste of time, but it was the mental outlook. You sort of had a sort of a sick parade in an army style. If you could get somebody a half a teaspoonful of this sort of stuff, he'd go away feeling 100% cured, and it probably didn't do anything for him anyways, but at least it was trying to survive. This was the whole secret of the whole thing. Ointments of any type, practically non-existent. Potash we did get hold of. That is what the army used for when you got bad feet for, you know, blisters and that. Well, it's good for anything. Potassium permanganate, you put it in the water, makes the water turn blue. It's a good disinfectant of any type. We used to, fellows came with bad feet from beriberi. This is the swelling of the feet and these sores, and you'd bathe their feet in potash. I treated a lieutenant who was under my care when I was in North Point, and he had wet beriberi of the testicles, which is a very painful thing and a very nasty thing. Very, very difficult to treat. Practically couldn't treat it. And I can remember, I had a job, I had to bathe them with this potash, a mixture of potash and water. And it was always a nasty mess. His testicles swollen up to about the size of a large grapefruit, each one. And just a running mass of sore, you know, right in the groin. Very bad case. I treated him for, about 2 weeks. And then he was taken out of our camp to a place called Bone Road. That's a sort of a civilian hospital in Kowloon. And that's the last I seen him, but I heard later that he did die. Gangrene set in, and this particular captain died of gangrene set in. There was, what would you call these, happy feet or Hong Kong feet, which means your feet are just like going on fire all the time, and to say the worst thing in the world is to put it in cold water, but it seemed to be the only relief. The fellows, especially in the cold time there, you could put ice in the water, and after the fat left in there for 10 or 15 minutes, that water would be warm. It'd actually warm the water up, and they wouldn't even feel the coldness, no way. Feet just on fire all the time, burning like blazes. You know? That's just from malnutrition, the lack of diet. Mm-hmm.
Was there still organization in the ranks in the camp?
Yes. We were still organization, military organization. The Japanese, when they took us over, their officers were in Pali with our officers, and they said, so long as if we would disciplinary ourselves and run it according to a military procedure as we've always done, under their, of course, jurisdiction, they would agree with this. Otherwise, if it wasn't, then they would put their men in and they would hand it out. And we knew that this would be deadly if they came in beyond that barbed wire fence and they were going to dish it out. So we helped defeat it to a certain point by running a military camp under our own sergeants and officers and so forth. And although we did, we'll admit we didn't work 100% because there's always sometimes we get into trouble with the Japanese guards and somebody get their teeth kicked in and so on. But majorly it was run military by our own people, you know, under the Japanese rule.
Mm-hmm. Did you do any work in this camp?
Well, in Hong Kong, as you say, I was working as an orderly, like, or just putting my time in there. And then themselves, no, not anything to any. Oh, pardon me, I'm wrong. Yes, they did. They worked at Kai Tak Airfield. Mm-hmm. That's right. I almost slipped my
was
mind.
Was this while
there.
They were at
in
North
Hong
Point?
Kong? Yes. There's a. No, this is in Hong Kong. You see. Mm-hmm. And in Kowloon, there's a Kai Tak airfield there. It still is there today, but it's different when we were there, of course. And they took out a detachment of working crew every day to carry away this mountain that sat in the middle of that airfield by a spoonful at a time. One of these buckets, you'd load the buckets up with dirt and carry it Chinese style down to the water's edge and dump it and go back to the mountain and take another spoonful out of it, back and forth. And they were also cementing the runway. They were laying cement. And yes, this was the working part.
How long did you stay at North Point Camp?
North Point, all told between North Point and Kowloon, I'd say, just about a year, Yes, I think it was I think it was about the beginning of February when I went to Hong Kong. So about a year, just a little over a year in those two places. Mm-hmm. About 5 and 7 of each, about 5 or 6 months in North Point, and the other time in Chanchipol. Mm-hmm. And then January or February of 40, what would that be, 43? 41 we were taking prisoners, 42. 43 when I left there for Japan.
What was the trip to Japan like, and how many men went?
Oh, roughly in the group that I left, there was 200 of us. Oh, wait a minute, 200? No, 400, yes, Camp 3D, 400. Between 200 and 400, roughly, so long ago. But anyhow, we left...
Was this the first draft to Japan?
No, I was the second draft. I wasn't on the first draft. There was a first draft, and evidently we heard by the grapevine that they were torpedoed. And I had a rough time. But I was in the second draft that left, and it was uneventful. And the Tatua Maru boat, white, big white ship, run up to Japan. Most of the prisoners of war were stowed in the hold of the ship, just about pretty well standing room only. And I wasn't in the hold. I was up on the first deck, and it was crowded. It was just a small, looked like a dining room with the dining room tables and that. So we pretty well either sat or laid on the dining table. Our whole trip there and back. Other than getting up to go to the washroom, when you came back and you either sat in that seat by the table, or at nighttime you couldn't find room, you laid on top of the table to sleep. And that's and it was about about 2 or 3 day run. So yeah, about 2 or 3 days up to Nagasaki, where we got off and got on the train. And from there on train up to Yokohama. And that's where we disembarked our particular group and went to a place called Camp 3D in the outskirts of Yokohama.
And can you describe this camp?
This camp was one story. The original was a one story camp, two long huts surrounded by a bamboo fence. Tall, about a 12-foot bamboo fence run all the way around the camp, with the administration building at the head of it. It wasn't a camp that you might say well guarded by barbed wire and of that nature, because it wasn't necessary, because you ain't going anywhere on the other side of that bamboo fence, no way, because you're surrounded by Japanese on the other side too, just as well as anywhere else. You're safer indoors. You don't get mixed up with the people outside. And just two long huts with a bath supplied. You had a bath about every 14 days. That was your day off. It was the bath day and wash up day and clean up camp. And then you worked an average of 14 days. One day off, go back for another 14 days. No weekend, like that. You work on an average of 14 days stretch of a day off every so often.
How many men were in each hut?
About 150 in each hut. So you had to make it about 300. 100 in each hut, or 150 roughly in each hut. And then eventually they moved into new quarters right beside. They made a double decker, which is upper decker and lower, which is a little different than newer, but much similar, same administration.
What about the sickness at this time? Was it worse?
No, just about the same. It never, you see, in the camp, your rations was governed by the number of work parties you put out in the factory, because the factory were responsible for the feeding of the prisoners of war, so for the civilians, you see. And for example, out of 100 men, if you had 50 men that were had to stay in camp sick, that meant you only got 50 rations to go over 100 men. Because, I mean, we still have to feed the sick. I mean, you don't, because the man's sick, you can't say you can't feed him. He'd die then, for sure. So this means that this was one way of the Japanese forcing people to really get out and work, because, you know, if you felt a little sick, you went to work anyways. The only way you could stay in is if you're really bad, that you just couldn't make it, you passed out and that was it. Well, then you had to stay in for a rest for a day or two to get your wind again. Well, but if you're too many, well, everybody'd starve to death, I'm sure, because the Japanese could care less. You know, this is the attitude that that's your business. If you all go sick, fine, you don't get nothing to eat. And if you all die, then that's the last key. We get prisoners of war from somewhere else. No worrying about you. You know, no bartering.
Was there any medical supplies in this camp?
There was some, but very, very sparse. Very scarce. Captain Reed was our medical officer in charge of the 3D. And his always was a bugbear. It seems that the medical things was even scarce in Japan, never mind anywhere else. I believe even the food must have been scarce, because they said that we ate like kings and the people were starving. But I don't know. I think it was the other way around. Yeah.
What about the food? What was it like?
Pretty well the same as in Hong Kong. They said that when we came to Japan that we'd be fed much better, but we couldn't see much difference. You still got that rice, or, well, it wasn't even rice, it was barley, really, red barley, which probably was maybe better for you than rice, probably. The Japanese claim that white rice is a luxury, and no way was prisoners of war going to get white rice, because that was just for, you know, the very elated people. Well, who were asked to argue, really? soup, you got... they brought in greens, which we made the soup out of. We called it the green horror. And that was like pumpkin tops and around the middle stuff. And it was just boiled up and put a little bit of soy sauce in it. And you made up a soup. Daikon was another thing. If you got daikons, well, then you just got daikon soup. And that's like a giant radish. And you just slice it up into slices and then you boil it up and help yourself, you know. But... I found that anything that was food, I sure could eat it. The only trouble is, no matter how bad some of the stuff was, I couldn't get enough of it. Now, this kind of seems kind of funny, but when you're starving, they serve you anything, and today I would stick my nose at it, but then, if I could get more, I'd do anything just to get more of this garbage, because you're looking to fill the hole. I don't care what it was. You know, you say dandelion tops, great. You know, I'll eat the roots too, they give them to me, but oh no, the roots are too important, they keep them themselves. We just get the leaves, you see. And that's nature, you see.
Did you have beriberi yourself?
Very slightly. I had a touch of beriberi. I fared fairly well, considering. The only thing I guess that hit me was optic atrophy, which is a my eyes, I went blind for a while, and it was the destroying the pupils in the eye, hemorrhage, you see, from the lack of vitamins, and then it left scars on the retinas in the eye, so I'm partially blind from that. I wear glasses not to read, and that's fine, you know, but it'll never get any better, and hopefully it'll never get any worse, you know. I found that Energy-wise, which is most of our fellows, it seems that when we get tired or we work at something, it takes us so long to bounce back. You know, generally you can get a good night's rest or get rested up and boom, you're raring to go again. It takes 3 or 4 days after you get so tired, you get a good rest, and it's about 3 or 4 days later before you start to come back. And as we're getting older, I don't know, this seems to increase, which is probably only natural because you are getting older. But even when we were comparatively young in my early 30s, so hard to bounce back because the energy wasn't there. You know? It's something we never got back again. Just destroyed something. But even medical science are at wits ends, and sometimes it's just why you don't bounce back fast. We give you vitamin pills, but they don't, you know, they go to a certain point, but then they seem to cut off, you see. And there's nothing there to work on. They seem to bounce it back. Mm-hmm. Medical people could explain, I mean, I can't. Mm-hmm. I just relate my feelings, just how it feels, you know, or just what happens, you know.
Yeah.
And that respect.
What treatment did they give you in the camp for the struggle with the eyes?
Nothing. No. The only thing they could teach there would be a good shot of vitamins. And there just wasn't any. Mm-hmm. Some of them had much worse. Some of them really had bad. Some of them went to their feet. It attacked different people in different ways. Like we have some of our fellows where the vitamin deficiency went to the feet and got this wet beriberi, and even to the point where they lost their toes. They just sort of just shriveled off and fell off, you know, just rotted away. We had cases of gangrene where it was where we had lost a few gangrene heads, and we lost them. We couldn't, even when the amputation couldn't save them. The diphtheria took quite a toll, and we were trying to get vaccine. We eventually did get a little vaccine in, but before we did get the vaccine, before we get under control, we lost 5 and 6 every day. We're dying of diphtheria. There's another funny thing. Some of our fellows were carriers, took diphtheria and yet never succumbed to it. Rather strange. I can remember one of our chaps, one of our bandsmen, who was an orderly, and he took diphtheria, and the diphtheria gland, it's like a yellow gland, and it lodged in his nose. So it generally lodges in the throat and chokes you. This is how you die from diphtheria, it's a choking up of the throat of the diphtheria gland. And it lodged in his nose, and he blew it clean and through. Now, normally, that man should have never lived. And even Dr. Crawford says, I don't know how, but he just got rid of it and just was a carrier for a certain amount of time. He says, this is just 1 in 1,000. Normally, your number was up. And he's living in Vancouver today, Gerald McKnight. Yeah. Yeah, strange.
What type of work did you do at this camp?
I was in the pipe bending department, where we took a pattern of a particular pipe, anywhere from 3 to 6 inch pipes that go through a ship, you know, the water system, and they were brought to this plant where I worked at, where they had a great big table with holes and a big steel table with the pegs in it, and the forges on the four corners, and you heated the pipe. And you put the pattern on and marked it, heated it, and then bent it to the shape of the pattern. And when they were finished, they were taken out of that shop and went to a place called the flange shop, where the flanges were put on, welded on, and from there on down the assembly line to the ship to be put together. So I was a pipe bender by profession. Yeah.
Did you ever try to sabotage any of these pipes?
Yes, and we did some nice work at it too. I can recall now, I wouldn't then, because I wouldn't be here today if I had said what I'd done in a foundry shop on the way back. It was in the rolling mill where they roll out the steel plates that go on a ship. And this rolling mill, incidentally, was made in Glasgow, Scotland. It was a British rolling mill. Huge room. And on each end of the big rollers is a great big grease cup that holds about 4 gallons of grease that goes in there. It greases the bearings on the rolling mill. Well, we just took half the grease out when we, you know, was watching and filled it full of sand and then put the cap back on. I'm telling you, we seized up that rolling mill, and it never operated all the time we were there. And we put it out of commission, and the parts could only come from Scotland to repair it. The Japanese held an inquiry about that, and rather strange that they had a bunch of young kids working there, civilian prisoners, you might say, civilian. They were just young kids going in reform school, and they worked in this plant also. So I think they took most of the blame for fixing this thing, because they were little buggers anyways. But we were saying whether they did or didn't. They didn't. That's their business. That was one. On board ship, this is my own experience of that rolling mill. There was other forms of sabotage done in the camp, especially on board ship, and also in the dining room. The dining room went up in flames one time. There was a fire and burnt up mostly upstairs. Now, that was, we find out later, after, even after we were prisoner of war and returned back to Canada, we thought that was an accident, but we learned later that was an accident on purpose, because up above this dining room in the plant was the drafting room of all the plants, and they made good short order of the drafting room, which you can imagine quite caught a havoc. And that was part of the sabotage work done while we were in. The chap that was responsible for that is dead today. He's from the Eastern Regiment. Can't even think of his name now. Staff Sergeant he was. He was in charge of the dining room.
Where was this again?
This was in just out of Yokohama. Not Kawasaki, but just out of Yokohama.
And this was on the shipyard. Was taking you to Japan.
No, this is the shipbuilding yard.
Oh, in the yards?
Yeah, in the yards that we worked at, yes. And there was a dining room in the shipyards
where
you had your midday meal, you see, while you were in the shipyards, which is about 2 miles from the place where we were in Camp 3D, you see. Yes. That's strange.
How long were you at this camp itself?
I left there on May the 8th, 1945, specifically. And there I went up north, because this is when we were getting heavy bombing, you see, and the area was getting unsafe to live in. Mm-hmm. So on May the 8th, 1945, we moved up to the northern part of Japan in a place called Sendai 1. That's a mining, a coal mining area. And I was in the camp, the 200 just went to that camp. And there I was there for 3 months, because, you know, the war was over at the end of August, yes. Very fortunately, otherwise I wouldn't have been here today to carry on through winter, because we wouldn't have survived that camp. Uh, 2,000 meters below the surface, it was what you call a drift mine. It drifts in to what you call a rock face level, and there you get off, and you get on another carriage which drifts back down another 2,000 meters down to the coal face. And from there you are dispersed to the different shafts where the coal is for mining coal. And at the face of the coal is about 110 degrees of heat. And there you drilled, charged it, blew, then mucked the coal out, then went back in again and did the same procedure. You did your 8-hour shift before you returned to the surface. And Jenny pulled out about 14 to 20 carloads of coal a shift. That's what they expected. You don't get it, you stay there until you get it. And bring it up to the surface. You know.
Was the sickness just as bad?
Bad in that camp, yes. There was British POWs there prior to us. But as you know, we were there during May, June, and July, and August, like, and the news that we had brought out of Tokyo, because we were in Yokohama, like Tokyo, and we were able to get Japanese newspapers, which is printed in English, and we were able to get fairly up-to-date news as to the war fronts. We knew of the capitulation on May the 8th of Germany, practically firsthand. and we knew how things were going pretty well generally in the southern part. The Japanese paper says it was always victories, but we could trace these victories getting closer to their back door. So we said, well, yeah, it's another victory. They'll be landing in Tokyo next. You know, and we could sort of read between the lines, and our news was pretty authentic. And towards the end, the Japanese were getting a little jittery, and we knew that the writing was on the wall. Now, when we arrived in this coal mine, where these British POWs were, who had been taken from Thailand during the beginning of the war, and all down in through there in Burma, and these poor devils, we thought that we had a pretty rough time, but I had yet to see prisoners of war look like they did. They were just, when you say a walking skeleton, they were sure walking skeletons. And they had no news of anything, period. And they had no, they had given up completely. They were browbeaten. And they generally had a very, very, very rough time. When we arrived there, we were just, as you say, with all the news that we had, and our spirits were riding just a little bit high, and we just didn't take too much from the Japanese anymore at this stage. And I think the guards, and most of us could speak fairly well good Japanese, and we could converse with the Japanese, but these British didn't even know the first thing about Japanese. And with our control of the language and our optimism about things, we sort of set their guards back on their heels a little bit. And of course, it was a wonderful uplift to these British prisoners of war who couldn't believe it. And when we told them what was happening, and that was just a matter of months before it was all over, they practically just wept with, you know, pure feeling. They just couldn't believe it, and yet we were the proof of it. And it was rather a heartfelt thing to see, really. And they had lost a tremendous amount of prisoners. Well, they said they were a fairly strong camp there prior, and they had given up completely. One more winter of this, and said there would be nobody left, because they were reduced down to about 60 strong out of about 500. And there were only 60 of these left, and they were pretty bad shape. They wouldn't have never made it. And as I said, if we had to go through a winter around 40 below, I think it would have knocked us out too. But as it turned out, the A-bomb came along, which we knew nothing of. And that's another story too. When that thing was dropped, and even the Japanese, they didn't know what it was. And when they told us that a bomb had dropped and that the whole city was wiped out, we said, well, boy, the Americans are bigger and better blockbusters. That's all we could think of, was a blockbuster. What's an A-bomb? Who heard of an A-bomb? And no, such, you know, this just wasn't in the cards for us. It's just a big, big bomb, that's all.
What about the medicine? I guess it would be even less, was there? The
yes, very there. Yes, even less. Medicine always was just non-existent. The only time when we started to get any of that was after the war, when the air dropped. This was one of the things that we asked for almost immediately when they came over and asked, what do you want most in your camp, you know? And we laid markings on the ground for the B-29 that came over to drop. And one of the main things was medicine, period, you know? Mm-hmm. And they made sure that they dropped ample medicine and those supplies, and then, you know, just rain food like it was going out of style.
What about the food in the camp? What was it like?
Prior to the war?
Prior to the Americans.
Yeah, same thing again, you know. Just this, seemed to be great for their soups, you know. There's this, I guess, the easiest thing in the world to make. And you've got little rice and this damn soup. Even the civilians, I mean, this is what they ate too, you know. Well, they just got more of it, that's all. When we get our ration of this green soup or whatever you could put in water to make something out of it, that's what you got. Fish was once in a blue moon, beef once in a blue moon. Like, for example, 500 men would maybe get about, three or four horses' legs, you know, but without the meat on, just the shanks. And the hoofs still on them. Even the horseshoes, I think, were on some of them. I'm sure they put that in the soup. You know? And stuff of this nature, you know, you wouldn't get such a thing as a horse's head or a cow's head, because, I mean, that's that's out of this world. I mean, they get that. You just get the leftovers that they couldn't really, you know, and so little of it. You can imagine, say, 50 pounds of a bone with a bit of meat on it. Well, there's good in it, I have to really admit. And make and build up for a soup for 500 men. I mean, you knew that there was meat in it because it had a little oily substance on top of your, you know, so they must have got some meat in today because there's an oily thing on that stuff, must be. So we ate it with gusto. Yeah.
Did you ever get paid while working in the prison?
Yes, we got 10 cents a day. This is in Japan. 10 sen, we call it. Yes, 10 cents is 10 sen to 1 yen, you see. And every 14 days or so, you got a payday, so you got paid your $1.40 for your 14 days' work. And then you brought in a canteen, you see. And so this is where you could spend your money, $1.14. And cigarettes was about 60 cents a package if you could buy them, but you couldn't buy them. You're only allowed to maybe buy five. See, so each man got, say, five cigarettes each, so that cost you 5 cents. It's half a day's pay. This is not how we kept smoking. Actually, you can well understand, because we used to black market in the, you know, the work and get cigarettes that way, and or else mostly pick up butts. You know, you could find butts and, you know, where they dropped them, and we'd dive on them and retrieve the butts and take them home and break them open. We had a little can we carried to us all the time, and that's where we kept our tobacco, you see. And get some brown paper and just roll it up, and that's what you... it's rather ironical, like, no, I don't smoke now, but during my prison war camp, I'd say smoking, because I did smoke, it was half the battle of me being alive, because it did ease off the tension. And whether it was a smoking or drugs, you name it, doesn't make any difference. It still had its point. And so I would never smoke, talk against it, because it did help me, you know. And all of us that smoked, that were able to get a cigarette once in a while, certainly relieved the tension, and this is the name of the game, eh? Yeah.
How did you find that the Japanese treat their own men?
Well, they believe in capital punishment. And if the most devastating thing to happen to any Japanese is to lose face, this is just unheard of. And that's the greatest punishment you can inflict upon any Japanese, as you say, to lose his face. So in their military, I'm talking about military because we were under military all the time. And if a private in their army or any of their men did something wrong, he was being punished for it. Not like we, you bring up in front of an officer and you get 2 days CV. He takes his punishment right there from his sergeant, who laces right into him. And of course, if he lifts his hand in defense, then it goes on to the next one, and the punishment is even greater, even if it still goes on, which it never does happen. But if it did, then the sergeant has a right to draw a sword and can kill him right there without any provocation. It's perfectly within order.
What about the Japanese treatment of, like, the Canadian prisoners compared to that of maybe American or British
Americans,
prisoners?
I'd say that on an average, I would say the treatment was pretty general. But the Japanese being, and I found them, an excitable race, and anything that excites them to a pitch on anything at any given time gives them provocation to act. Now, when the American flyers were shot down over their own country, and they were taken prisoners, you can well imagine, if it wasn't the civilians that got to that poor devil, if the military did, and still being in the fresh scent of battle, they went through some pretty bad atrocities. In fact, it is a well-known fact that all airmen shot down over Japan went to an unmarked prisoner of war camp for 30 days prior to be given a prisoner of war number. If they survived those 30 days, and I dare say a great number never did, they were just lost in action. Because after 30 days, then they were registered as a POW. Now they got a record, and it starts from there. So you can imagine how many reached that point. And this was their code, you see. So it was pretty rough. I'd say that same thing with the British POWs, that they seem to hate their guts even more so. The Americans and the British, they hated them. Us, at the beginning, they kind of puzzled. America, we know America. Canada, what are you doing here? Like sort of idea, you know? But seeing that you're here, you're going to get it. But second thought, it kind of took the sting out of them, you know? Why are you here? We ain't got no war with you. It's Americans we're at war with, British we're at war with, Canada. Yeah, but we're allies. Yeah, you're allies, you know, but I don't know, I still don't know why you're here, you know. You're no business, go on home. But still, this was seems to me, this is the impression I got from, and being able to, you know, speak fairly well in the language and talking to them, especially some of the civilians. But it didn't ease the pressure off as far as food is concerned, which you were concerned about, or treatment if you got into it, you got it. But just not with the gusto, I would say, like the British Tommies did or the Americans. I mean, this is my opinion of the three sectors of armed forces.
What about the interpreters that you had in the camps?
Yes, we had... And they were not a very good experience. We had one called Kamloops in North Point, and he was a typical Japanese, but he was sort of brought up and educated in British Columbia. So that's why I call him the Kamloops kid. And he must have had a very bad upbringing. I mean, or treated as a you know, as a colored race in BC or what, I don't know, because he made up for it when he was a top dog. And now he had the whites under him, and he led you to believe that with no uncertain terms, that now I am the master, you know. Now you're going to get something what I got, you know. What he got treated like, nobody knows, but it must have been pretty bad, because he was real nasty. I believe he was executed after the war on war trials, Kamloops kid. I believe he was for his atrocities, which was... second to none. He, I mean, his like the soldiers and that had, you know, who were just like soldiers of Japan. I mean, they had their bit too, but nothing like the interpreter, the particular one. Now we had an interpreter in Yokohama in Camp 3D. We called him Mushmouth. We didn't get these odd names. Now he was our, he was fine, and. But he was born and raised in Japan, you know, he'd never been out of it, and he was a camp interpreter. Could speak good English, you know. But we had no problems with him, and rather he was rather a likable sort of chap. In fact, some of our fellows, I think, after the war has gone back and has looked him up, and he has done fairly well with presents and stuff that we have given his family and that after the war was over. Because he was a pretty fair shooter, no... hanky-panky like this other character, you know.
How did this Mushmouth, as you would call him, how did he end up being a camp interpreter?
Now, I don't know, but I imagine he was probably what we call, say, an E-category man, you know, like in our forces here. But then being he's very well educated and could read and write English very well, and not being fit for military service, what better man for a camp interpreter in these camps, you see? And this is probably how he came about his job in during the war years in Japan as a camp interpreter. Much the same as camp commandants, were generally ex-active army officers who, instead of being, had done their tour of duty, you might say, maybe had been wounded in China, in the China Wars, are not physically for frontline or for soldier work, and political, you know, you never know. There's a job for you for the Jurist camp commandant and so on. That is in Japan. Now, a little different in camp commandants that was in the active field, like in Hong Kong, which was an active field almost, you see, away. Most of them were colonels and generals who more or less come back out of the front line idea into a camp commandant job, say for 6 months to a year, almost like a rest period, and then maybe sent to another theater of war or something of that nature. And this is roughly how that comes about. Much the same as our own, I imagine. You know, the different types of things.
What about at Sendai? Was there an interpreter there?
No, there wasn't, I think, as an interpreter, although the camp commandant and I could speak good English. And our officer, Captain Reed, was in charge of us. Well, I mean, like under our own rule, like sort of. But there wasn't an official camp interpreter there that I know of. No, there might have been prior to us reaching there when the British were there. I don't know, just offhand. I do know that when the war was over, the guard that was on, they were a pretty rough guard that was there. They were pulled out about 2 days prior to the war being over, and a new guard brought in. And these are all university students and speak perfect English. Oh, and entirely different stamp of guards altogether, just the bug face. So this probably was a method of madness, because we probably would have killed all those guards. Yeah.
Now, with the end of the war getting nearer, mm-hmm. Were your daily quotas in the mine cut down?
No. When the end came, it came rather abruptly. It came within a matter of 3 or 4 days, like, you know, when the end came, it came in a hurry. It didn't lead up to an end like in the mines. Mm-hmm. Not like it did out there when we were in Yokohama. Yokohama took about 6 weeks, or even more than that. Things were starting to slow up a bit, and the areas were around there starting to get bombed, and production was going down. There was a lot of interruptions going to the working plant with air raids. Would be maybe in the middle of the afternoon, we'd be sent back to camp and kind of air raids coming in, or we wouldn't get out to camp till late in the mornings. You see, we'd cut down the working day because of air raids, and production was falling off, and things were coming to abrupt end quicker there. But in the coal mine, you were in the mountains and you were sort of isolated from all this, you see. And so when the end came, it came rather abruptly at the end. In fact, when I went, I was on a night shift, and when I came up that morning from the night shift, the day shift wasn't in. So when we got back to camp, and said, "Well, what happened?" Said, "Nothing, just that the war's over." I said, "You're kidding." "No, the war's over, that's why we didn't come to work today, you're kidding." "Well, no, we were just waiting for confirmation on the radio." And that afternoon we got confirmation right in our own camp from General MacArthur in Tokyo Bay.
Had the Japanese guards left by this time?
Yes, they had left just prior to that. Yes, the old guard, as I said, the new guard came in that could speak English. Just about, you know, they were just changing guard, you see, but we didn't know why at that time. But this, because we were not told, you see. Mm-hmm.
But the Japanese guards that were guarding you did stay on duty, the new ones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. But then just as soon as General MacArthur gave us the word, so we took over. And the guards, that new guard was there, was only there for a short time, then they were dismissed. And we took over the guard ourselves. We put on belt and bayonet and sidearms and mounted our own guard in our own camp. Had the freedom of the camp, and we went in and out as we pleased. Into town and so on and so forth, and down into the little village that was close by. I can remember doing that. I can remember taking chocolate bars and getting a haircut and being shaved, shampooed, and the whole bit by women Japanese barbers, right in their own shops. And you think, gee whiz, you don't have a chance of it. No way, huh?
What was the reaction to this? Like,
not a thing. It's rather strange, yeah. You know, here we were free. I was dressed in my first uniform was an American coveralls, you know, those green coveralls. That was the first bit of dress I got, and that's what I wore. And I wore that pretty well right through until I got to a depot where I got a Canadian uniform again. But I wore this coveralls and a good pair of boots, you know, American boots. And of course, we had our sidearms. We had belt payments. And no guns, though. No guns. Just about a minute.
Uh-huh. So how long was it before the Americans just start dropping supplies from the time that the
time
surrender?
To surrender? Just about within 2 days, they had our camp spotted and they're dropping right away. The first plane that came over was a plane off the aircraft carrier, who circled our camp and dropped a half a package of cigarettes, or a half carton of cigarettes, and a lighter and a note in it, and brought right on our freight square in the middle of the camp area. And you know, and just said he was Lieutenant so and so, and the American Air Force, and what's the name of that carrier? Can't think of the name of the carrier, but and this air carrier out in the bay, and that he'll be back in a short time with some meat. And so evidently he was scouted back, and he was back within a half an hour or an hour, and dropped us about 50 pounds of meat. Must have got from the kitchen on board the ship. And says that there will be supplies coming in. So I guess he spotted and sent this little bit of stuff, and then the next day B-29s came over, and they dropped it. The big drums with the big parachutes on. And we went and salvaged the drums of food and the parachutes, and they're all soaked parachutes. And we gathered up these parachutes, and went into town and sold the parachutes for 1,000 yen apiece. Then we came back with all this Japanese money. I had a couple of parachutes, I sold them, a couple of 1,000 yen. Then I came back into camp and played poker with this money. Oh, one time there I had piles of money, you know, just playing poker. So what good is it, you know? They didn't care. Shoot the 1,000.
And how long was it until you did leave the camp?
Yes, about, I was in that camp for about 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, before we pulled out, before we got orders to get on the, and they brought a train into the mine. There's a railway runs into the mine there. They brought a train in and we boarded this train and we got orders to move out from Tokyo under American command. And we moved out and arrived in Tokyo, and we were received by the Americans, band and all, the whole bit. And there we were taken immediately to briefing. And briefing to, they outfitted us with new clothes, the whole bit. The briefing was rather brief, a medical which was brief. Anything that we'd brought out, they asked us to leave and sign for, like helmets, bayonets, Japanese swords, or anything that you'd on and turn it over to them, and they'd take a record of it and claim it back later, you know. But they, all this stuff, diaries, all that sort of thing, anything, all the stuff that they're looking for, you know. This was the briefing, you see.
These last 2 weeks in the prison camp, what did the men do? Did they just go in and out as they pleased?
Yes, pretty well, yes. You did your general routine, you know, like wash, shave, have your breakfast or whatever. There was lots of food, you see, because there. And there was periodically parades for... parade this afternoon for boots. Anybody who want new boots, there's a parade this afternoon. All like military, you see. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be an issue of cigarettes this afternoon. You get a couple of hundred cigarettes per man. See, because all the stuff that we retrieved from the air, from the bombers that dropped, we work parties, you see. We retrieved all the stuff, brought it back in the camp, and put it into a warehouse, you see. And you say, under our own administration. And then we sorted it and handed out to the, you know, and you get all you want, but in an orderly, light manner, you know, the general camp routines during the day. And you were able to just say, come and go as you pleased. We went outside the camp. If there's a truck coming down the road, he commandeered and told the Japanese to hit the trail. You took his truck over. Or me and another chap, we commandeered a walking down the mountain road, a Japanese officer coming towards us, and we stopped him, and he bowed and all the Japanese stuff, and he had a beautiful big sword, and we took the sword off him, and told him, keep going. We disarmed him right there, took the sword, and I rule the day today that I didn't keep that sword. It was a beautiful sword. A samurai sword, that's a top-ranked sword. And I buried it or hid it. I can't remember now. I don't even know where it is. No idea. But I didn't keep it, and I wished I hadn't. Because knowing what I know now, I see I could have brought that sword out and brought it back. But I didn't know then, you see. Because I had a prize and didn't know it. But anyways, during the camp and the camping days, we always go down this little town close by the mine, as that's in day one. We also discovered another camp about 4 miles away, Camp Sendai 2, another prisoner of war Canadians, and we sort of had a little reunion with them. They're up on the side of a hill, their camp. We discovered that while we were there for that 2 or 3 weeks. And we mixed with the population, people, and it's just like normal. And as I say, our chocolate bars that we had got, you'd practically, you know, you'd buy the place for chocolate bars, period, you know. No problem, we didn't need any money. The money was useless, you know. And we thought the money wasn't any good. Yes, it wasn't much good, but we accumulated quite a bit of it, but threw most of it away. Gambled it away or threw it away, and who needs it? Who wants it? You know, it's just garbage. Yeah.
What were your thoughts about you'd be leaving the camp and going back to the a way of life that you'd left just about 4 years ago? Were you thinking about any changes that would have been made during that time?
Yes. We thought, no. See, once we got back and got back to Canada, you know, just what we would be doing, but you didn't give too much thought of it. You knew that eventually what we were going to be doing, returning to civilian life. And that, no, I can only speak personally on that. Myself, being a musician, I figure when I get back, that's the main thing. I really didn't think too much beyond that, but I was hoping to stay in the armed forces and carry on my career as a musician, because this is what I really wanted in life, was to be a top musician in band work, and the only way I would do it would be to stay with the armed forces. And this I certainly intended to do. But unfortunately, I got medically discharged, unfit for further service, so that ended it right there, so I had to take second choice. And at 28 years of age, 27, 28 years of age, I was thrown out on the city street. No trade, no or nothing, but as things worked out all right, I eventually, for the first while, I just sort of lived for 6 months money I had, and I spent money like it was going on the style. I had enough of it. And then when it came down to the fact, well, I better start looking for a job. So I started to work for the Hudson Bay Company, and I've been there ever since, and I'm not sorry that I didn't get the biggest money at the time, because my health wasn't that good, and I figured I don't want to get into something that's going to pull me down, that I won't be able to make the grade. I'll just have to just take it easy. So I got in with the Hudson Bay Company and eventually got on staff there, and I worked myself up in the China department, and I've been there ever since. And another 3 years from now, I'll retire. So I think that worked out.
Coming home from Japan, how did you travel? Did you fly or go by
I
boat?
I flew, yes. Some came by boat. Myself, I flew from Tokyo Bay to Guam. In Guam, I stayed for about a week in Guam and saw the Charlie Ruggles show. And from there, I went to Honolulu. And in Honolulu, I was there for a couple of days. And then from there to Frisco. And I was in Frisco for a couple of days in the clearing station until we got in touch with the Canadian embassy and got $10, I think it was, our first Canadian money. Something like that. And he said, we need some money. He said, what do you need money for? I said, well, it's a good idea. Then we got $10 on a loan, so I forget what it was now. And then we boarded a train and came on up to Canada. And when I arrived in Vancouver, and there I got a new Canadian uniform and breathed that Canadian air again. And I tell you, it's like the wanderer from Wandering on a Foreign Strand. You know that poem? Well, this is just what it felt like. And when I seen the Canadian Rockies and the Canadian prairies, I thought, well, was it worth it all? And I thought to myself, was it worth it all? And I thought to myself then, when I'm coming back, if I had to do it again to preserve this, I would. And this is the way I felt. I never felt so grateful to land in our own home soil. Say, this is what I fought for. This is what I sacrificed for. Is it worth it? And I can say this to anybody. It sure is. To what I had seen, and then come to see this, I'd fight again for it if I had to. You know, and this is the way I felt about the whole thing. So a lot of people say, well, what about animosity against the Japanese? I says, well, I said, what about your animosity against the Germans? I said, it's the same thing. Regardless of who it is, they were the foe. But you can't blame a civilian population for this, because no way. They're human beings just the same as you. And if they're of the army was pretty atrocious, I know. And maybe they've learned a lesson in what they've done, and maybe they haven't. But this is the way they were educated. This is the way they were brought up. So what you couldn't expect in the other way. So you don't take this out on the future generation. No way. It's the same way that they wouldn't take it out on us either, you know. And you get to coming through all these experiences, it sort of mellows you, you know, and it sort of calms you down a little, and you look on both sides very, very closely. And then you weigh the value of things much more deeply when you had to fight for it than if it was given to you for nothing. And you know, a lot of young people today that never experienced a war or never gone to war and never had to fight for what they have inherited sort of take it for granted. But when you bought and paid for it, the fruit is much more tasty. You know, and this is my experience. Yeah.